Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode number 19, titled The Danger of Just Meditate.
There's a great thing going around in America now, a big panacea thing, like just meditate. You just meditate, you can be like, you know, working for Grumman, making like attack helicopters, but you meditate, you'll be cool. And it's really not the case. It's not, at least it's not Buddhism. You can palliate some of your anxiety by just meditating with an empty mind, with trying not to think, or with an ordinary misunderstanding of reality that we ordinarily grow up with and are educated in. But if you just meditate that way, you only palliate your anxiety. You will never overcome it. You will not come to enlightenment, which means an understanding of the nature of reality. You will just temporarily dampen down your worries. And because we worry so much, we think when they dampen down for a little while, we think that we're enlightened. The danger is we will think we're enlightened, because we know we can retreat back into that dampened down state. And then that removes from us the motive to make the non-dampened down state a little less worrisome, a little more jolly, a little more cheerful and happy. And if you just imagine a little bit disappearing into a vast space, you can imagine that some of you may have genuinely had that experience, and therefore may somehow secretly, not really telling your spouse, because she probably wouldn't serve you dinner, or he wouldn't give you car fare, or whatever, but thinking secretly, maybe I a little bit got enlightened because that disappeared. That must have been enlightenment. Secretly thinking. And we can point to some examples in history of yogis and people and teachers who claim enlightenment because they experience disappearance. And then they go around saying, I experienced emptiness, so I'm enlightened. But that's very, very mistaken. They did not experience emptiness. What is the famous Prajnaparamita thing, which you all know? Although I consider it a bad style and also mistranslated. You know, emptiness is form, and form is emptiness. Emptiness is not other than form, and form is not other than emptiness. But that's a mistranslation. I translate it. Voidness is matter, and matter is voidness. Form means matter, not form. It's a mistranslation from ancient time in Buddhist circles. From Plato, maybe, the forms, you know. And also the word rupa in Sanskrit, which is what it translated, can mean a visual object for which they pick form. And it's defined in Indian Buddhist thought or science as form and color, shape and color. But they just take form in general. So there it's directly translated as form. But as an aggregate, you know, which is one of the five aggregates that is meant here in Prajnaparamita, it's matter. And that's what's shocking about it. If you say vaguely form, oh yeah, voidness is form is, oh, you're sure of that, yeah, that's cool, I'm cool with that. No, voidness is matter. That means that this solid supposed thing, hand and armchair, chair arm, that is voidness. Not some space inside it, or not when it blows up or disappears. It itself, as matter, is voidness. You follow? That's where the shock is, really. Or that is emptiness. So this is all emptiness. So we're in emptiness. And we can't really realize emptiness in that kind of grasping way, because the realizer is just as empty. Well, emptiness is realizing emptiness. Big deal. Thanks, emptiness. Good for you. I didn't do it. You don't realize emptiness. You melt into emptiness. That's right. But the shock of that is you melt into emptiness and you don't disappear. You're sitting around with a bunch of unmelted entities who are like looking at you like, what are we going to do now? Okay? So, now the way of however, that illusion-like aftermath samadhi is a really important thing. And I mean, the space like Kirtanapur Samadhi is a really important thing. And it's very, very valuable. And I want to read a little passage, one of my favorite passages from the Lekshi Nyingbo, where Tsongkhapa totally blew my mind many years ago. Still blowing it every time I read it. It's one little paragraph. Nyugutawala, ranking who here with Zimbabwe. They remember Zimba. They need Gangi and Jebu do Majevi, Zimba Sum Yula. Tao Jevi Jula, Sumba Yuja, Tao Manevi Jula, Tampu and Tama Nila, maybe Chebra Nam Lever Shena. Tope Dio Niam to Gansun Tamsi, Ligbe Mingopata. Tao Jula Maje, Gongi, Changsu, Sem Jonas so, of a Tamsi Denzin and Tenzin to Dunan, Niamme. Tao Jula Jevi Lombe Otu, Jun Chok Tamsi. La shizi maybe low down and legber juro, legber kekber juros. I'm sorry to do it. It's just such an amazing thing. I know you guys all know Tibetan. In English, in regard to things such as a sprout, they always talk about sprouts. It was agriculture in the ancient India was the agricultural side of it. Sprouts are a big thing. You know, when they talk about causality, there are three perceptual habits. One, holding it to be objectively existent. One, holding it to be objectively inexistent. And one, holding it without qualifying it in either way. There are these three perceptual habits in regard to any object, and they just mentioned sprout, but any object. If the distinction is clearly understood that all three of these habit patterns exist in the mental process of one in whom the realistic view is generated. Which doesn't mean full enlightenment, but it means, am I doing that? I am? Exploding here. All right. One, because I'm looking down, I'll look up. One in whom the realistic view is generated. All three, that is, objective, that pillar is objectively existent, it's also objectively inexistent. And also it's sort of neither one. All three of those perceptual habits exist in the person who has realized the realistic worldview, the first branch of the Eightfold Path. Right? Which means they have analyzed and become to a level of wisdom, that means. They're not fully enlightened, but they have a level of wisdom, of non-dual wisdom. And only the first and the last, but that only the first and the last are present in the mental process of one in whom no realistic view has been generated. Then one will put a stop to the following false views. Okay, now just think about this for a minute before we go to the false views. The more enlightened person has the perceptual, has in their mental process the perceptual habit that really exists with intrinsic reality. That really doesn't exist with intrinsic reality. It's intrinsic reality that really doesn't exist. And some sort of way of seeing it without any kind of qualification as to really existing or not existing, just sort of relating to it, without kind of investing it with either intrinsic existence or intrinsic inexistence. Do you follow? Now, you can sort of get it, because that means that me, who haven't really gotten realistic worldview still, as much as I've studied after all these years, I have a little, but not really deeply. But still, that means that I always see everything as realistically existing, as intrinsically real, having self-nature, or all these different ways we turn, intrinsically objective, intrinsically identifiable, having intrinsic identity. You know, the pillar is really a pillar. I see it like that. I feel myself like that. And then I can sometimes perceive the pillar when I'm looking over there and I see a pillar peripherally and I don't think about what status is. Right? But I've never seen it disappear under analysis. So I have no perceptual habit that sees through it, kind of, if you follow. That knows that it's illusory, seeming to be intrinsically real. But if you have attained space like Ekopoise Samadhi in a true experience by looking, if you've experienced some degree of selflessness, in other words, by looking for the self, that first step of the experience of selflessness, where everything seems to disappear, including the self, then I have at least some seed of that perception of it as intrinsically non-existent, if you follow me, everything that I see. So I see it as illusory. So I'm balancing my investing it with a tremendous solidity, I'm balancing that with an investment that it will disappear under analysis, with the seemingly as if I had an intrinsically real experience of emptiness or void, which when I experience it seems intrinsically real. That seems like that's the deeper reality. That's where I land. But although you never know that you've landed there, because when you disappear, it's like that disappointing thing that happens in the dentist chair. You get that sodium pentothal in case you ever had a tooth pulled and that dentist used that. And you've been wearing all day and all week and all month and all year, and tax time came and went and all this stuff. Paid all those tickets, whatever you did. And you're about to be really obliterated for a short time. And then they say, get up and get out of here and stop bleeding in the chair. And it's an hour and a half later. And there's no sense of time in the obliterated state. There's just a threshold buzz, and then they throw you out. Because obviously when you're completely unconscious, there's no sense of time. Similarly, it's sleep, even sleep. If you were enlightened by disappearing, everybody's enlightened because everybody disappears every night. They have some time of deep, dreamless sleep, which there's no sense of time in, because there's no subject-object registry. So we'd all be like, we could all run out and say, I experienced emptiness, so you pay my parking ticket. Okay? So the point then is that the state of disappearance is not it. Now, in another plane, the dualistic Buddhists, Theravada, Mahasanghika, and the Tibetan Buddhists are Theravada Buddhists. I want monks, and even lay people. The monk's vow of the Buddhists, we go on about Tibet's Vajrayana Buddhism. That is really a little bit wrong, because all the monks have Theravada Buddhist vows. There are no Mahayana Buddhist monk vows. Monks and nuns are Theravadins. They are. It's because the monk and the layperson thing, and mendicant and layperson thing, is a dualism. Right? And samsara nirvana is a dualism. And by becoming a mendicant, they're heading for nirvana to get out of samsara. So they even have a theory that the disappearing is nirvana, actually. And of course, they get like Shariputra and the Lotus Sutra, that they get a big, fat disappointment when they think they're going to disappear. But then they're standing around, and Shakyamuni says, go get me a cup of coffee. And Ananda, they say that. They had a disappearance. And then they appear, and then they have a theory that, that disappearance was nirvana, but there's a momentum. I have a samsaric momentum of my body and my conventional mind, and therefore I'm going to hang out like an arhat for some while to hang, because it's so much fun hanging out with Shakyamuni, because he's so cute. And I'm going to do that, but luckily when I die, I'll revert, since I'm not afraid of that dissolution state, I'll revert to that dissolution state, and I won't be reborn, and I won't have to hang out anywhere else anymore. And you can read it in all those sutras, this is my last birth, and no more to be done, and blah, 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 and goodbye. And then when Shakyamuni dies, they say he's done parinirvana, which means he's also died and gone. And in the ancient arguments, which were not as numerous as you think in ancient India, because most of the Mahayana people were Theravada monks, like in Tibet. And mostly the glory and magnificence of the Mahayana worldview, they loved it and they embraced it. But there were some holdouts, which then were called Hinayana, which was not all Theravada monks. It was only those who Hinaed themselves. Hina means deprived. It doesn't mean smaller. It means deprived. And they deprived themselves of that magnificent view of the Buddhaverse, the Buddha land, the Mahayana. The land filled with jewels, incredible, marvelous vision of the Mahayana, filled with Buddhas, Buddhas in every atom, incredible people. And they deprived themselves. That's why they were called Hinayana. only those who refused that. But those who did so on the basis that Buddha doesn't have a body. Attaining Buddhahood means you realize you don't need a body. You just dissolve into this vast infinity. Now, Buddha himself, in the Theravada scriptures, which were oral for many centuries, he told them. For example, there are four formless states, or four immaterial states, as it should properly be translated. These are states beyond the speed of light. Einstein thought everything was ended at speed of light because he thought everything was only material. But beyond speed of light, it's the super subtle energies are there. And there are these four states. And the first of them is called infinite space. The second one is called infinite consciousness. It sort of fills the space, but there's no sense of duality of the person who reaches those four states in the sense that their consciousness is just everything. But somehow, without thinking consciousness, because they're not doing any verbalization, they don't have bodies, ordinary bodies, they're in a vast consciousness. Then being in a vast consciousness seems a little bit disturbing to them, or too busy to be a consciousness with no object, just like a spreading, an infinite consciousness. So then they go into a state known as the state of absolute nothingness. But it's a state, it's not absolute, now there is no such thing as absolute nothingness. But there's a state that seems like absolute nothingness. That's the third one. And that seems peaceful to them. You know, it's more peaceful than being in infinite consciousness, too tiresome. I'm infinite consciousness, it's really boring because there's nothing to be conscious of. Because all there is my consciousness, much better to conk out. And then the fourth one is most subtle, the state beyond consciousness and unconsciousness. Now that those four states, when the Buddha left the palace, remember, in his life, in all versions, his first guru, in the first ashram, his first Hindu or Vedic, there was no Hindus at that time, there were Vedists. His first Vedist guru had a yogis who reached the state of absolute nothingness, and they thought that was the ultimate, and that was ultimate reality. And they say that Buddha reached that state himself in one day, because he was like a quick study. And then he said, that's not absolute. That's just a state of oblivion, not the absolute. So he said, thanks a lot, I don't want to inherit. Because the teacher said, you can now lead the group. You know, you can be my successor. He said, I don't want to do that. That's not the ultimate. Goodbye. He went to the next guy, who then reached beyond that to the state beyond consciousness and unconsciousness, which the Hindus call Turiya, even still today. And they think that's nirvana. And Buddha said, no, those formless realms are not nirvana. They are states you can attain, and actually they're rather dangerous states. Because when you reach them, if you have not learned ahead of time the royal reason of relativity, the teaching of selflessness, you will reify your condition in those states as the absolute. And then you will not bother with your human body any longer. If you came from there from being a human yogi, it will seem much too boring for you, with all the real problems, all the medical issues, and you will become a deity of the formless realm. And you'll stay in there for many aeons, and then you'll suddenly have a big shock and you'll land back on West Broadway, if you're lucky. And you wonder, where am I, what am I doing? And you wasted all that time, and you didn't achieve enlightenment, and you didn't become a bodhisattva, and you didn't help anybody, and you just got stuck in this reified absolute state. That's why Buddha was careful to tell. There are those four states. And actually, it's good yoga to develop the stability of concentration to be able to go into them if you know that any state that has a barrier between it and an ordinary state is a kind of extraordinary state, but it's still a relative state. Because an absolute, there's no such thing as an absolute state that a relative being can enter. If it has an entry point, it's relative. It's just logical. So since it's a relative state, a seeming absolute relative state, you enter it by a causal process, namely of meditative expertise and stability, extreme stability of mind, and then that cause will exhaust its force and you will leave it later, if you follow. Whereas nirvana is defined as the uncreated, having existed primordially from the beginning, and therefore they undestroy it. So actually it's always been here, or it's worthless. And in a way it's not here, because here is a relational word. So then it becomes, then they say we can't talk, you know, like they go, well, I don't know, that kind of thing. But then they talk forever. But nirvana in all terms, like avoidness, nirvana, selflessness, they're all negational terms. That's the key point. And a negation is not a positive thing. The non-elephant in this room is simply the failure to find the elephant. It is not a thing in this room, if you follow. And similarly, in the Parinibbana Sutta in Pali, when the Buddha attains Parinibbana, he gives them a big fat hint, which the dualist people don't get. Where if you go read that sutta, you will see his mind goes up out of the desire realm, which is the human plane, into the realm of pure matter, and up to the 9 planes of pure matter, no, 16 planes of pure matter, you know, 3, 3, 3, and 7, the 4 measurables, right? Love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And then goes up through the 4 formless states, just to sort of hone the one-pointedness. Then does not go to parinirvana out of the topmost formless state of beyond consciousness and unconsciousness, comes all the way back down to the base of the realm of pure matter, between the material realm and the pure material realm and the desire material realm, and then goes back up again to the boundary between the highest part of the realm of pure matter, which is called Akanishta, or Brahmas, which is where the highest Brahma dwells. Although there's 2 branches of Akanishta. There's where the higher Brahma dwells, the world god, and then there's the plane on the event horizon of infinite space where all the Buddha lands exist, actually, in Mahayana. It's that plane where Amitabha's pure land is and where all the sort of celestial Buddha verses are. And then disappears into Parinibbana from there. So very cleverly, given the hint is that the disappearance from his physical ordinary body, human body, or not, it's not very unordinary, the Shakyamuni's body, but still it's close to an ordinary body. But he disappears from that in a plane between the material and the immaterial to indicate that it's something other than just the abolition of materiality. It's not, in other words, an obliteration. And I have a new meaning for the word parinirvana, actually, myself, which is that recently came to me, which I enjoy, sort of non-dual definition of parinirvana, because pari means thorough or total. So parinirvana, total nirvana, means totalizing nirvana by leaving the appearance of a separate body that beings sort of relate to as like Buddha's over there. The Buddha joins with nirvana, which is all beings and everything everywhere, the Dharmakaya. So he totalizes nirvana. But when he leaves this one, he's like nirvana in all of us. That's part of it.